The information and opinions presented in this ARC Energy Ideas podcast are provided for informational purposes only and are subject to the disclaimer link in the show notes.
This is the ARC Energy Ideas podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas podcast. I'm Jackie Forrest.
And I'm Peter Terzakian. Welcome back and Happy New Year. This is the first podcast of the year.
Yeah, it's 2021.
I'm going to have to get used to that. So what did you do between 2020 and 2021?
Well, it was pretty quiet. We got lots of value at our Disney Plus and our Netflix subscriptions. And we did do some cross-country skiing, which was nice. And with that big dump of snow we got, that was helpful.
Yeah, the big dump of snow was really nice. We did some snowshoeing and so on. I mean, the equipment sellers for winter sports are just going nuts from what I hear. It's sort of like the bicycle sellers were in the spring of last year.
Yeah, there's really not much else to do other than try to find some things to do outside. So luckily we had a lot of that equipment from a long time ago. I haven't seen that, how busy it is, but I'm sure it is.
No, sit back, sit by the fire, play some games. We did that. I mean, pretty small pod. Just my wife and I. So.
Yeah. And here we are. It's funny. 21's going to be all different. But I'm like, so far, I feel like it's exactly the same. Pretty small circle of people you're seeing each day.
Yeah. Same kind of just bizarre news flow coming at us. But I think that we want to talk about some of the bigger macro issues, as we usually like to do.
Yeah, I think the topics for this week, we'll talk about some of the news. The year is off to a bang when it comes to the news cycle. So we'll talk a little bit about some of the energy-related news. We wanted to talk about your three foolproof predictions. You can make foolproof predictions these days, Peter, is pretty ambitious. So we'll talk about those. So Peter wrote on our commentary right before the break that we'll talk about. And then I wanted to talk a little bit about the Canadian energy policy barrage that finished off 2020. There was just so many announcements and papers and strategy documents that came out of the federal government. So that gave me stuff to do over the Christmas holidays, reading all that. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And I really want to talk about the announcement of the $170 carbon tax by 2030, because there was a lot of discussion about that at the end of the year.
Yeah, discussion about that, the low carbon or the clean fuel standard. There's just so much going on. But why don't we start with what's going on the other side of the world, the surprise announcements by the Saudis.
Yeah, so that was big news starting off the year. The Saudis surprisingly announced a voluntary 1 million barrel a day cut to their production. And according to the current Saudi oil minister, the decision to remove this volume came from the crown prince himself. And he said the move should be seen as a gift to support the market. And I would agree, it is a gift to support the market. You know, the price arguably has got a little ahead of the fundamentals. It was around $48 when this announcement was made. It moved up to $51 after that. Why I say the price got ahead of the fundamentals is the fundamentals, especially over the next few months, looked a little wobbly. You know, we had weakening demand, potentially with lockdowns growing. We have more OPEC plus production. They had agreed to add about 500,000 barrels a day back into the market in January. You know, we had more production from Libya. And so there was the outlook that we would be putting a lot of oil back into those storage tanks over the next few months, and maybe even more than we think, because demand may end up being weaker. So this really helps create some stability to the market by taking that extra supply out.
So sort of support for notional, what I would call the notional fundamentals, because, you know, there was sort of the expectations that the vaccine was going to solve things quickly. There still is, with the caveat of what the definition of quickly is. Then there was the stats. If you looked at the oil consumption and imports in China, were actually pretty robust. We talked about the traffic congestion being back to normal, if not worse than it was a year prior. And so, you know, you put those things together and there was a sort of wind in the sails, if you will, of oil price to go higher. We talked about that just before year end. But from a barrel count perspective, if you sort of...
Especially for
barrels,
the next few months,
yeah,
right?
Supply because barrels minus demand barrels, it did look wobbly. And maybe the Saudis saw that and said, okay, we're going to rein it in. And by the way, when we take a million barrels a day off the market, which is 1%, the price is going to go up by 2%, or 3%, which it did, right?
And that's exactly it. And I would say, by the way, I didn't mention that it's only for a few months that they've agreed to do this, for February and March. And I think it's a relatively small risk to them. You know, they are showing, though, one of their hands, which is that they value price over market share at this moment. And maybe it's a fairly small risk because they're looking out past the next few months and saying, you know, demand is going to come back. I see what's going on in Asia. I feel pretty confident of that. therefore, well, let's just have that a little bit higher price for the next few months. And beyond that, I should be able to get that supply back into the market because demand should come back.
Yeah.
So it's more of a temporary move.
And the price did go up. I mean, actually, I was saying 2 or 3%. It's more like 6%. I mean, it went from $48 to $51. And we're almost $52 today as we record this.
Yeah.
Podcast.
So they're saying, hey, I'm ahead in that. I'm producing less, but the price is higher by doing that. And it takes risk. Mm-hmm. I mean, it also gives a gift to U.S. shale producers who weren't expecting prices to be at this level for the next few months. Now, the question will be, will those U.S. shale producers go and invest that in new capital programs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a funny cartoon that's been going around. The gist of it is whether or not basically the oil and gas companies are going to take the cash flow increment and put it back into the ground and drill again, or whether they're going to give it back to their shareholders. And, I think, though, that there's another dynamic, which there's a big question mark in front of us. Will investors be coming back and give more money to oil and gas companies or not? I suspect it's too early for that.
One question, I think, does this show that there's a little crack in the whole OPEC Plus group, because obviously there's been different strategies here. Russia, it looks like, is valuing increasing their production more than price. They value market share. And here it's looking like Saudi is saying, you know what? I'm more important to me right now is price. I'm willing to lose some market share here, at least in the short term. So I think, you know, this is a gift to the oil industry for the next few months, and it's helpful. But does it show maybe less stability to this relationship in terms of managing the market?
Yeah, I mean, the whole game theory behind how each of the participants behaves, especially the larger participants, has always been something to watch. It creates tension. But I think that as long as price goes up on a percentage basis faster than the loss of any market share or any forfeit of market share to any individual player, then they're all satisfied. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what's happened here.
Yeah.
I
mean,
bump is pretty significant, and the demand return expectations are looking pretty robust, and the inventories are being chewed away in part by the cuts that are being made by the OPEC Plus members. And so this is setting up to be potentially supportive for firmer prices as we go into the latter half of 2021.
Okay. All right. Well, let's talk about the next big news story for the new year, the Democrats winning 2 seats in the Senate from this Georgia election. So now it is 50 seats Republican in the Senate and 50 seats Democrat, with the Vice President Harris able to break the ties. However, there is this filibuster, and if you want to understand that better, we had RJ from Eurasia Group on our podcast November 6 explaining that. But basically, you require in the Senate 60 total votes to pass any major legislation. So there's a lot of people that view that this is helpful for the Democrats, but they're not going to be able to get radical big legislation in, like the Green New Deal or something like that, because of this filibuster requirement. But I would say the equity markets took it as a positive signal. If you look at a basket of solar stocks, they moved up anywhere between 10 or 20% the day that, you know, it was recognized that the Democrats would have some control of the Senate.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing. I mean, the expectation that they will be able to push through with more conviction, more certainty, the Green New Deal type of policies, the $2 trillion, was definitely supportive to the clean energy stocks, especially the renewable solar and wind. But there's many others. The hydrogen stocks, I know, moved quite significantly. And so there is an expectation, arguably, sort of almost maximum price to perfection expectation, that all this money is going to be spent, and a large fraction of any stimulus money to get the economy rolling again in the United States is going to be spent in the green, clean economy space.
Yeah, and I think we're going to hear more on that. Unfortunately, this big news was overshadowed when those rioters stormed the U.S. Capitol. And I guess there's 5 people dead now, and it was basically Trump supporters fighting against the counting of votes to confirm Joe Biden as president. So that was really sad to see that.
Well, it is sort of a tragic circumstance, and we could talk a lot about it, but from an energy perspective, the Biden administration coming in on the 20th and all eyes on stimulus and where that stimulus dollars are potentially going to go.
Okay, well, let's talk about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
For those that haven't been following it, you should.
Yeah, this is a story that is, I think, very consequential to the energy markets. So Bitcoin, which has rallied dramatically again. So if you wind back, I don't know, a few years, Bitcoin was, a couple thousand dollars. It had a rally to $20,000. Everybody was amazed. A lot of people said it can't last. It didn't. It fell back down sub 10,000. I think it even fell back down to 4 or 5 momentarily. It was sort of in hibernation, I would call it, between $5,000 and $10,000 US for quite a while. And then all of a sudden, just before Christmas, again, it starts surging. And now it's at 40,000 US the last time I looked at it. This is really dramatic. And why it's so consequential to energy is a story that I think is going to unfold going forward. It has many different dimensions to it. First of all, mining for Bitcoins is very energy intense, requires a lot of electricity to drive high performance servers, computational devices, to be able to, quote, mine for Bitcoins, and requires a lot of electricity. But the rewards at a $40,000 price are tremendous. And so all of a sudden, you get this incentive for people to set up their own computer in their basement, plug it into the wall, especially if you have cheap electricity, and start making Bitcoins. So you're going to see more people, like we did when it surged to $20,000, plugging more and more computational devices into the wall to make Bitcoins, because it's such a lucrative spread between the value of the Bitcoin and the amount of electricity you use. But you can expand that to the corporate level, which is what we saw here in Alberta, because we have cheap electricity in this province. In Canada, actually, in general, has very cheap electricity. It's got high-speed internet access. And by the way, it's a cold climate. And those are the three things you need to be able to industrially mine for Bitcoins. And so we saw installations start popping up in Alberta where you take, say, stranded gas, convert it into electricity with a simple generator, put a computational farm to mine the Bitcoins, solve the algorithm. And the conversion makes the payback rather fast for some of this equipment, especially at this kind of prices. So I think you're going to see more industrial Bitcoin operations in jurisdictions that have cold climates because it's less cost to cool the computational equipment in places that have high-speed internet and in places where there's very cheap electricity.
Mm-hmm. Or energy like natural gas. And, you know, it's a win-win in terms of, you know, there's gas, natural gas that is flared or vented because it's such a small volume that it doesn't make sense to build a gathering system. And these can be kind of a win-win because they can take that energy that's being wasted and creating GHG emissions with no value. And, you know, they can capture that, turn it into electricity and create a revenue stream
off
it.
Yeah. So that's at the, you know, at the margins, that makes sense. There's one more thing I think that is really important with this Bitcoin thing. And that is that the reason it's surging up by all accounts is because all of a sudden we're getting institutional buying of the Bitcoin. It's not just the retail buyer, which was the case when it's rocketed past $20,000. And we're not experts here in whether or not Bitcoin's going up or down or on the volatility. But the dynamic that is important is that it's becoming more and more legitimized in the currency world.
Yeah. And there's different theories too, not only as it being a future currency for digital economy, but it's a way to diversify from the US dollar, which is depreciating, and hedge against inflation. There's all these different theories.
There's all these different things. And so when it gets legitimized and it's not attached to any central bank, all of a sudden it has knock-on effects in terms of the geopolitics. The Russians are very keen on cryptocurrencies. The Venezuelans have been keen on cryptocurrencies, the Iranians, and basically any country that has sanctions. Because all of a sudden you have a currency that can't be controlled by a central bank, and effectively it becomes easier to skirt any sort of financial sanctions. And I think this is going to have some profound effects, if it hasn't already, in terms of the trade in oil going forward. So it's a space to watch for sure.
Yeah. Well, and as the U.S. has used more and more sanctions, that is actually one of the problems with it, is it creates this desire to get around them, right? And to use other currencies. And that's one risk of them using the sanctions as much as they have.
And it's non-traceable, generally speaking. You can't trace the Bitcoin. That's the privacy of the transaction is one of the big features.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we're going to talk more about Bitcoin in 2021.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your three foolproof predictions for 2021. We'll put a link to your commentary in the show notes. You basically had said last year, crystal ball gazers like ourselves were made a fool of as their 2020 predictions were wrong, completely wrong in many cases. But this year, you're putting forward what you are calling foolproof predictions for the new year. So tell us about those.
I don't think it's rocket science to say that we are going to see more green policies, not only in this country, but also in the United States. And so we're going to see that more of that forthcoming. But I think The subtext to that is that I think we're going to see more green investment from the corporate side. It's not just exclusively a government policy kind of story. We were already starting to see some pretty significant investments into the renewable space, the broader clean energy space, by the corporate world, not only by the big companies like the Amazons and the Apples and Microsofts of the world and so on, but now we're starting to see, for example, airlines get into spending money on mitigating carbon emissions. So sort of this catalyst that's occurred, and I think it is on the backs of not only the policies that have been put in place through the course of, say, 2019 and 2020, but also because what we're seeing is the tremendous market returns that have been generated by some of these clean energy companies, including the electric vehicle companies like Tesla and others that are now behind it. So the seeds are in place for recognizing that there is money to be made in this space now. There's a tremendously low cost of capital. In other words, money is easy to get. And so the investment into this space is going to, I think, continue to accelerate, and it's going to come more from the corporate world than it is from the government. And I think that nothing is foolproof, but we're already, even early into the new year, we're already seeing signs of that.
Hey, and by the way, for the record, I went back and looked at our predictions for last year, and one of the things we predicted is corporate pledges to reduce GHG would grow, and that for sure happened, and maybe even in a bigger way than I would have predicted. We had all sorts of companies. You talk about it, like airlines. We had industry associations, for example, the Canadian Steel Producers Association committed to net zero. You had big steel companies around the world and other industrial companies, big oil and gas majors, some of our Canadian oil and gas companies. And in fact, Newfoundland and Labrador committed to net zero, and their industry associations supported that move. So all of this is going to result in more spending in this area, and maybe has been a bigger trend in 2020 than I would have predicted a year ago.
Yeah, I think the switch that's been flipped over the course of the last 12 months or so is the realization that, okay, there's actually money to be made by investing in clean energy technologies. And you mentioned the solar stocks and the bump that it got. Okay, that's based on expectation. But there's no question that we have seen the cost curves of solar and wind come down dramatically to the point where they can be installed and have economic returns in the absence of any government policy now.
Well, and governments have committed to, for example, China net zero by 2060. And now we got Joe Biden, and Canada, as you know, has plans to have legislation as well for net zero. But one thing that investors say is, you know, when you look at policy, it comes and goes, you get different governments in, it seems less stable. But when you see these corporations commit to these net zero targets and put money behind them, it does give a sense of more stability because, you know, these companies are going to be around for decades and are going to continue to spend. And I think it creates a little bit more certain environment for investing.
It does. It does.
Okay, prediction two.
Yeah, the oil and gas companies are going to continue to consolidate. I think that this is just a necessary evolution of the business as it responds to the competitive threats of other energy systems coming into the fray. The precipitous drop in the oil price as a consequence of the pandemic was viewed to be sort of the end of oil and the demise and all that kind of stuff. But actually, if you look at the business dynamics of what happens to a company when the price of their product goes down, is they tend to think about, okay, how can I innovate my processes? How can I become more efficient in my production to stay in the game longer? Prior to the pandemic, it was seen as $50 being the notional level of sort of treading water for the industry. Now we're hearing companies 45. And so that's a 10% drop. So I think that the pursuit of cost efficiency is going to be essential for anybody in the energy game, including the oil and gas business, and that consolidation is a way of reducing costs.
Okay, but here's a question for you. Now we got this little gift from Saudi Arabia here, and prices are $50 WTI. Mm-hmm. Is there no more pressure to consolidate? You are well above treading water now, and you don't have the pressure mm-hmm. to reduce your costs anymore.
I think the pressure is going to be there because the cost of capital, in other words, the ability to access debt and equity, is still very, very high. And the larger companies, especially the ones that are demonstrating cost efficiencies, greater profitability as a consequence of consolidation, and also environmental performance, are the ones that are going to be able to access capital. Smaller companies will still have a lot of difficulty in doing that. And so scale is going to continue to matter going forward as we head towards the goal of net zero, as we head into a world that is increasingly cost competitive for producing a jewel of energy from whatever source.
Okay. So the pressure's still there.
The pressure's still going to be there.
And I would also say, because of the last year, there's a lot of debt in some of these companies, more than they used to have, and that will create some pressure as well.
Yeah, and I think you would agree that, yes, the price of oil is going up, but it's a cyclical business, right? It doesn't take much for it to bring it down again. I mean, it's an up and down. It's always been very volatile.
Okay, what's your third prediction?
Well, the third prediction is that energy demand is going to rebound quickly. And maybe that's not much of a prediction, but as I said, this is sort of foolproof. I just looked at the stats and the data on the other side of the world, places like China and Southeast Asia, and they said the congestion, the traffic, the oil consumption numbers have all rebounded dramatically. In fact, in some instances, they're above 2019 levels in 2020, which just seems, you know, shocking given that we're the state that we're in on this side of the world. But that tells me that there's a lot of pent-up demand to get moving again.
Well, those are the three predictions. We're going to revisit those at the end of the year, Peter, and see how it turned out.
They're foolproof, right?
Yeah, they should be. You don't even have to revisit them, but we will. Okay, Canadian energy policy barrage that finished the year. So I'll just quickly list some of these. We're not going to have time to go over them, but we will as we go into the year. We've got the Liberal Climate Plan, which was titled A Healthy Environment and a Healthy Economy. That was released December 11th. There was a lot of information in there, but the thing that really made the news was the announcement of a $170 carbon tax by 2030 in Canada. I want to talk more about that on this podcast. But there was also the draft clean fuel standard legislation. We obviously had a podcast on that in December. I tweeted out a link to the actual legislation. It's something like 200 pages. And then there's supplemental data that is, you know, many hundreds of pages more for all those people that like to read a lot, but there's lots there. There was a small modular nuclear reactor action plan. So what the government is committing to, as well as many other actors, like 100 partners, including companies that want to deliver on deploying small modular reactors in Canada over the next decade. So we're going to learn more about that on future podcasts. We had the hydrogen strategy released, and we talked a lot about hydrogen on our podcast, but I recommend it for those interested to look at that strategy because there's a lot of good background on hydrogen in Canada. It included both blue hydrogen and green hydrogen, the technology, the economics.
It's a very detailed read. It's got a lot of good background information because hydrogen is a complicated subject.
Yeah, it is. And I think what was nice about it, it really talked about all regions of the country. And so there's a little really good context. In fact, I'll probably put links to all of these things in the show notes for people. But let's come back to the December 11th, the Healthy Environment and a Healthy Economy announcement. With the announcement that carbon price would increase by $15 per year starting in 2023, rising to $170. And, you know, I think there was a lot of discussion about, wow, $170, what does that mean? So I wanted to just talk about that. I do want to talk about one thing that maybe wasn't talked about as much, is there was this notion that the majority of households would receive more in rebates than they would pay. So although you're going to pay a lot more when you use energy that has CO2 emissions related to it, you're going to get that money back. So I wanted to explain how that works.
Yeah, let's do that. Let's talk about the magnitude of this $15 per year leading to $170 by 2030. What does that mean in terms of gasoline price increase?
Okay, so let's talk about that in terms of natural gas and gasoline. So for gasoline, the carbon tax today is about $30 per ton in 2020. Mm-hmm. So I guess it's a little higher now in 2021, but that's the equivalent of 7 cents a liter. And if you put a $170 carbon tax on in 2030, that would be 40 cents a liter of additional cost. So in 2030, if you assume that you're paying about $1.20 a liter, I just made that up, for gasoline, you know, as it would be without a tax, then you'd be paying about $1.60 a liter at the pump.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting because at the end of the day, the carbon tax increases the price of gasoline at the pump. So the consumer is paying more. You can achieve the same thing if you think about a rise in the price of oil.
Yes, that's right. And we saw that in 2008, nine, when price of oil went so high.
Yeah.
You know, people did make different choices than they do today.
So $170 carbon tax by 2030, I back calculated, what is that the equivalent to in terms of a price of a barrel of oil, if you back calculate equivalent? Like, what would the price of oil have to rise to from today's, we'll call it $50, to give you the same effect at the gas pump? And the answer is about $80 to $90. If you look at the data, around $80 was sort of the breaking point of where people started to change behaviors.
So the next one is natural gas. Natural gas carbon tax today, you pay about $1.50 per gigajoule additional on your energy cost, which your energy cost is about $2.50. So there's quite a bit of tax when you put it in relative to your energy cost today. Yeah. And that your tax would actually rise for natural gas to the range of about $8.50 per gigajoule with the $170 carbon tax.
It's really dramatic.
Yeah. So basically your cost of energy, your tax plus your energy would be over $11 per gigajoule in 2030. And just come back to hydrogen. Remember, we talked about what it would cost to produce hydrogen. Hydrogen could probably be produced, blue hydrogen, cheaper than that. So it will create opportunities for alternatives to natural gas that don't have CO2, because the burden of the CO2 is quite high for natural gas.
It's going to be quite punitive to people that use natural gas in their homes, and retrofitting their home is quite expensive, you know, typically older homes and so on.
Okay, but this is the thing. It's not necessarily punitive, because the government is going to pay you every quarter a check to compensate you for the tax. So I did a little calculation. The Canadian Gas Association says the average person uses 90 gigajoules of natural gas a year. So basically that costs you, this tax in 2030 would cost you about $800 a year extra over what you pay today. And if you do the same thing, if you assume the average person drives 20,000 kilometers with, you know, an average efficiency car, you're going to pay about $827 a year more tax because of this policy. So in the range of $1,600 extra a year, you're going to be forking out because of this. But according to the government's report, they have a table here that shows the first adult in a family would be making about that much. Now, it varies by province what you're going to get back, but it's in that range. So you're going to be paying that out when you pay your energy bill, when you go buy gas. But every quarter, you're going to be getting almost that same amount back through this check. And so it's not really going to be a big burden for a lot of people. Now, if you're a real high energy user, if you have multiple cars, you drive way more kilometers a year, you have multiple homes, then you're not going to get all your money back. And if you're a person who doesn't have a car and lives in a small apartment, you're going to be getting back way more than you pay.
Okay, so let's talk about the average Canadian first. So their costs increase by $1,600 and some dollars, but they get $1,600 and some dollars back over the course of the year. So it's net neutral. When you get the checks from the government deposited in your bank account, you have a choice. You can go buy a bag of insulation, or you can buy a big screen TV.
Or you can just say, I needed that money to compensate me for the money out of my budget I used to pay for energy.
Right. If you just say I'm neutral, it doesn't really accomplish anything in terms of reducing carbon emissions. I mean, you have to recognize that you should take that money, buy a bag of insulation, or save up for a new high-efficiency furnace or heat pump, and therefore then make the calculation that I will be better off by not spending so much on energy, not emitting so much carbon, and when I get those checks from the government, it's going to actually make me further ahead than otherwise would.
I would argue that people will do that, because you're going to get the check regardless. So if you reduce your use of energy, or you reduce the amount of CO2 associated with your energy, then you're going to pay less. So instead of just being, I pay $1,600, I get $1,600 back, I'm going to do things that mean I'm only paying like $800. And therefore, I'm still getting, you know, a big check back and I'm ahead. So I actually think this will work. I think it will get people to reduce their use of energy, to consume cleaner energy. And at the same time, it will not be a huge burden for the consumer.
Yeah.
And, you know, the consumer is also the voter, and the voter won't be, you know, as concerned about this high carbon tax because they're getting these checks back. So I think the chance of it sticking around is much higher by doing it this way.
I have to admit, I'm a bit skeptical. I'll tell you why, because most people, if you ask them where their energy comes from, they can't tell you. In other words, the level of energy illiteracy is really high. So for people to draw a dashed line between the check in the bank that they get and reducing their energy consumption is something I'm not sure is going to be correlated unless there's more education.
Great. Well, and it's interesting, because how many people know that their natural gas price has gone up so much? You know, unfortunately, your natural gas heating bill, only about a third of it is energy costs. So even though we increased the energy cost quite a bit with the current tax, and I think a lot of people probably didn't notice that, when you get to $170, it is material. It is quite a bit more money each month. I think it will be noticed.
You know, we're in this world where your utility bill, you have an automatic withdrawal from your account, and the government rebate from this program that comes in is automatically deposited. And you're just sort of not keeping tabs of what's going in and out. I see how the average person draws the line that I should go to the hardware store and buy a bag of insulation. To me, that's the missing part about this.
Right.
Sort of the awareness that I can reduce my energy bill and come out net positive in my bank account and therefore reduce emissions. I think there's work to be done there.
Education's important. It's interesting also in this document, what wasn't covered, this is the healthy environment document that came out, the Liberal Climate Plan, is that they're going to give a fair amount of money for efficiency for people to improve things in their home. Okay, well, I think we'll wrap up for our first podcast of the year. We covered a lot of topics.
Yeah, great. So we look forward to the next one and stay tuned.
Yeah, and thanks to all our listeners. We hope you had a great holiday and thanks for tuning into our podcast. If you like the podcast, please rate us on the app that you listen to and tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.